Hello everyone, welcome to Trolling with Logic. It is the 20th of January 2013, 6 o'clock GMT, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Zulu, and we are a bi-weekly internet stream, podcast, whatever, focusing on issues of science, skepticism and secularism. You can call in today. It's very simple. Just add Skype contact Trolling with Logic, all one word. And if you do call in, please bear in mind the whole show is later re-uploaded to the internet. So you are granting us permission to use your likeness. So without further ado, I'll introduce my team for today. As always, Kitch.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Martimar.
Hi everyone.
And regular co-guest, Womble.
Hello, and this is exactly why you should never send me back into the kitchen.
And, well, before we get to the main guest for tonight, we have Ali on from Arab Atheists. Welcome, Ali.
Thank you. Hi.
It's good to have you back on. I just wish, circumstances were much better. So can you explain the situation going on right now with you?
Sure, yeah. So basically, for those of you that don't know, I am involved in another panel show, but this panel show is in Arabic. We talk about pretty much the same things that you guys talk about on this show. We talk about atheism, secularism, the importance of both of those things, and we kind of point out what's wrong with Islam, all this obviously in Arabic. And basically for the last year, we've had a prominent blogger, Arabic language blogger, by the name of Abdulaziz Muhammad Elbaz. And Abdulaziz is a strong atheist, and he's been one of the best and most outspoken people promoting our cause and promoting atheism and talking about it to all sorts of different people. Aziz lives in Kuwait, so he knew full well that he would be on the line of fire if something were to happen, and unfortunately something did happen. About a couple of weeks ago, we believe it's around December 31st, after a feud between Aziz and his boss, kind of like what used to happen during witch hunts in Europe, where you'd have a problem with your neighbor and you just accuse them of witchcraft or Jewry or whatever, and basically you'd get that person in trouble. Well, basically the same thing happened. He had a feud with his boss, and his boss accused him of blasphemy. And, of course, blasphemy is a serious crime in Kuwait, and it's punishable by up to 5 years in prison and some fines. And so after this feud, the boss, like I said, reported him for blasphemy, and it's not very difficult to come up with evidence against Aziz because he's so outspoken clearly outspoken against Islam in general, religion, a big advocate for secularism. And so basically the police picked Aziz up, and he's been in jail ever since. He's facing trial on February 28th, and we're receiving very little help. We believe that the state of Kuwait can be pressured into letting him go. The emir of Kuwait had been pressured to veto a bill that would have brought the punishment to death penalty for blasphemy sometime mid last year. And so we believe that the country of Kuwait can be pressured into letting him go if enough noise is made. And basically that's where this show comes in. We are asking anybody who can. There are things like this, petitions, a Facebook group. If you've got any contacts throughout the media or anything like that, we're asking that you make as much noise as possible. Perhaps set up maybe a protest where you live in front of the Kuwaiti embassy. Call the nearest Kuwaiti consulate or embassy. Let them know that you think this is barbaric and this tarnishes the image of Kuwait in the eyes of people. Write to your own government. Talk to your own congressman. Let them know that you want them to speak out on blasphemy in Kuwait, and to let Aziz go. There are already quite a few people who are helping, but we certainly need much more help. So anything that you can do out of all those things that I've just mentioned would be incredibly appreciated. I'm sure Aziz would appreciate it. I certainly would appreciate it very much if you could get this out, let people know, and try to make as much noise as possible.
Yeah, there was one question I did have. What kind of conditions would he be? What are the conditions of the prison he's in? Do you know?
So from what I understand, this is just a normal prison where all criminals go. It's the central prison in Kuwait where basically they keep everybody before trial. So we're not exactly sure. Information is very difficult to come out of there. We can't speak with the Interior Ministry. We can't speak with the jails. His lawyer has very exclusive contacts and will not give his contacts out to the rest of us. All the information that I've known came through the Egyptian embassy, and even then the information is very scanty. I'm supposed to be able to call back on Monday and get more information, but as of right now, I don't know anything about his conditions. The only thing we know is he's been there for at least 2 weeks and maybe even more, from January 2nd at least.
Yeah, and there was one other thing I heard. That, is it true that they're actually trying to speed up this trial, the authorities?
That's right.
Yeah, they are. Okay.
And is that
Is that quite common in Kuwait with blasphemy?
I think that maybe they're trying to get this over with as soon as possible and not allow for this thing to get out and have people badgering them. At least that's from what I understand. Again, I'm not exactly sure why it is, because we just can't get any information. I may be able to find out more on Monday as to why, but it seems as of right now that basically they're just trying to get this over with the least media coverage possible. And that's why they're pushing for a trial very quickly.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ali. We'll move on to our special guest, and I think we'll hand it over to Womble here to introduce her. And yeah, Ali's agreed to stick around for the rest of the show.
Okay, so this week on Trolling with Logic Show, the boys here have acquired the very well-known, at least in atheist circles, Tracy Harris, who has most recently hit the newspapers with a call-in from the recent, or one of the most recent, atheistic experience shows, where she pointed out the fact that, with most decent people, I would imagine, would do more than God would do, which is stop someone from interfering with a child. And so we have her here with us, distilling some knowledge and wisdom from her point of view, and she'll be answering questions in chat. If you put a text question in, we'll try and pick it up, or if you try and call in the show. So hello, Tracy.
Hello.
Well, welcome, Tracy. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I think I'll start off with, I've often heard on the show you said you came from a fundamentalist background. Can you expand on that? Like, what kind of, your deconversion, and then, before you started to deconvert, how fundamentalist was it?
Oh, it was pretty fundamentalist. In the church that I was in, there were people who didn't believe in dancing, non-instrumental worship music, no ornate or decor in the church. There was, no divorce except for if one of the partners commits adultery. So even if your husband beats you, you can't divorce him. You're allowed to go and live somewhere else, but you have to remain married. And I'm trying to think what else. They were very into literal baptism by immersion. If you're not immersed and baptized, you're not getting into heaven. They literalists as far as the Bible was concerned. Boys and girls can't swim together. It was pretty fundamental.
And so what was it that started your kind of deconversion or opening your eyes as such?
Interestingly enough, it was about when I got into college, I guess, I started to meet people that were telling me things that I had not learned, I suppose, in church, or things that didn't really coincide with what I had learned in church. And it was mainly less about my classes than about the people that I met who were making claims that I thought were not correct. And when I decided finally to shut them up by going and getting the citations that were required to make them understand that I was right, I found out that I was wrong. And that, I think, is what really, once you get that first domino, where something you think is a key, like one of the keystones of the foundation of your belief, and you go and you start to research that, and you actually, at that point, take the opportunity to go and question if what you've been told is correct. You don't just hear it and believe it and think that you've learned something. You actually have to go back and say, I accepted this as true and I felt like it was knowledge and I thought that I had learned something, but can I really trust what I was told? And so you go and you look it up, and when you see that you can't trust what you've been told in an arena that you feel is very key to what you believe, you start second guessing a lot of different things. And I think I think that's kind of one of the things that impacts a particular segment of believers when one big thing is you finally take the time to go and look and you realize that you're not correct. That's when they really start to question, and that's when I really started to question to say what else is not correct.
Okay. And what was that? What was that first seed of doubt over? What was the specific?
Well, the thing that hit me the most was I made friends with a Krishna in college, and he was extremely intelligent about the origins of the Bible. Like, he was well read on that, and he kept saying things about it, and I was just like, this doesn't sound right. And so I went and looked it up, and I always tell kind of, it's kind of like a broken record, I say it so much, but I just will always remember me sitting in the basement level of the five-story university library where I was going to school with all of these different books spread out in front of me. And one of those books was like a Catholic history of the church, and there were other books that were like encyclopedic, some books that were just about world history, whatever. And it was all about me just spreading these books out, looking up anything that was referencing anything about the Bible and how the Bible was put together, and just looking at all these different sources who were all agreeing on what my Krishna friend was saying. And it seemed like it didn't matter what angle they were coming from, whether they were religious or secular, they were saying he was right. And at that point, there's no way to argue it. I mean, I'm taking the word of like a church who has you almost have to say it's purposely shrouded biblical origins in shadows and darkness, because when you are a member of the church, there's this idea that the Bible is brought to you by God and it was dictated to men and handed down to you. And there's this gigantic gap of how exactly did that work that they don't really get into. And so it's not so much that you're lied to as that they leave out information that would make you say, well, wait a minute, this doesn't seem like it was something God did. It seems like this was an afterthought of the church and that they went and collected these letters. And why did they put this stuff together? And why did they decide to create a Bible? And what in the world made them do that? Because there's nothing about, God didn't tell anybody to do this. So it was really strange the way, you know, well, when you're indoctrinated, I think there's all these little tricks in place to keep you from thinking and to keep you from asking certain questions and to keep you from caring about specific knowledge. You just don't mention it and nobody asks about it, and it becomes a non-issue that nobody thinks about. And so when you do start to get off that script or to get into areas where they don't prepare you, you start seeing things that you don't expect that don't really support what you've been told.
Okay, and so what led you into atheist activism, like joining the ACA and then going on the show?
Well, I remained, after I left the church, I mean, obviously once if you're a biblical literalist and the Bible falls, you're pretty much out of the church at that point. There's no point to going anymore because you no longer hold that there's any reality to it. But it didn't stop me from believing in God. And so I kept believing in God for probably another 10 years after that. And I was just searching and searching and searching and trying to figure out what do I mean by God? What is it that I'm looking for? If I can't trust what I've been trusting to explain to me about God, then where do I get that information? What am I looking for? And what am I trying to find here? And what am I trying to connect with? What am I trying to explain? And that finally led me to the realization that there was nothing there. I couldn't pin it down. There wasn't a thing. There wasn't any definition. There wasn't any information. It was just like this big block of nothing that everybody claimed to have this, you know, this or that information, but nobody really had any basis for what they were saying. And finally, I was just like, you know what? I don't even know what I'm saying when I use this word God. I mean, I can't even explain this. It doesn't seem to mean anything. If it means everything anybody ever wants it to mean, it's a meaningless term. And if you have no, if nobody has any basis for it, then what's the point? And so I ultimately, you know, understood that that was atheism. And at the time I was living in Austin, where the atheist experience is broadcast. And I remember they were broadcast on public access television. And I think that there might be some public misconceptions about the access channels. Yeah. It's not like major network TV. It's not got a broad range of audience. It's like extremely limited in geography to where it goes. It's not at all being on public access television. Basically, anybody can be on public access television. You just have to go down. You have to qualify, get some licensing. I think there's a small fee, and you get your own show. So it's not like somebody puts you on TV. It's just like you go down there and you enroll.
Right.
And so the ACA was using that as a vehicle to sort of reach out in Austin, and they'd been doing it for a lot of years. And I, like a lot of people in Austin, had Austin cable, and I would flip through the channels, and if nothing else was on, you put on Access, because Access is actually kind of funny. So you had really funny things on Access, like Alex Jones was off and on, and he's like a big conspiracy theorist, and so he was awfully funny to, you know, watch most of the time. And then you had there was like one guy who wore a toilet seat around his head, and another guy who had this thing called the Deadpool, where he would take call in people, like people could call in and guess which celebrities would die. And if you won, then he would give away the sofa that he sat on for the show, and it was yours. And so there was all these crazy little shows that were on. But then you had real stuff, too. Like, there was a nutritionist here in Austin who sponsored, like, a little half-hour nutrition talk that he would give. And, you know, so there were some people used it for information. Some people used it for, you know, crap and giggles. And so you had all these different things. And one of the shows was Atheist Experience. And it was interesting because it was like a call-in show where they actually debated with people. It wasn't just calling in and just goofing. So people would call into the show, and I remember kind of just watching it casually every now and then when I would catch it. And the more I think the more I started to define myself as an atheist, the more I started to say, you know, I enjoy this program, because some of the people would call in and they would be talking about things that I also was impacted by as I was deconverting. And I found myself, you know, beginning more and more to call the show. And so I would be calling in and saying, hey, I, you know, heard that last caller. And I was telling somebody the other night, it was funny because I learned after a while that when I would call the show, I had to have a pad with me. And so I would have a pad and a pen, and I would be on the phone to the Atheist Experience, because when you're on hold, you can hear the other callers. And so I would have the reason I was calling kind of, you know, put out into an outline format. And then I would be taking notes on the prior calls, because I knew at that point that whatever somebody said before me, if I had a problem with it, I was going to want to say that too. So once I got on, I would just rattle off what I wanted to say really quickly, knowing that other people were waiting. But I would always have so much to say. And I think the one time I finally called in, that one of the hosts, I think it was Don Baker, kind of took my fast talking for exuberance. So he's just like, why don't you come down to the dinner? Because, you know, you're so into it. And I was kind of like, oh, no, I'm not a highly social person. I mean, I spend a lot of time alone, and I'm perfectly fine with that. And I was just like, no, I'm not really interested. But I was like, maybe I will. And I had kind of been kicking around this little comic strip that I was doing. And so I took it down to one of the show dinners. Like, after the show, they do a dinner, and I went down to the dinner. I brought a few of the prototypes for this comic strip and said, what do people think? If nobody likes it, I'm not going to waste time on it. But if I get some chuckles, maybe I'll do this for a little bit. So I showed the comic strips around, and people liked it. And I guess it was, I started just going, like, once I started to meet people and have a good time, I started kind of showing up at some of their events. Then they started asking me to join, and I put off joining for a while because I was just like, oh, you know, I'm not really a joiner. And so I'm just going to show up at the dinners and enjoy everybody. And they were just like, you should join. And I don't know if it was like a pre-planned thing, like, or if they just simply were promoting membership, but it was like a requirement of the hosts that you have to be a member, of course, of ACA. So after I joined, I started getting the, hey, you should be on the show. And I was like, I don't think that's me. I mean, all I could think of was I'm going to get on there and then lock up and I won't be able to talk. And I don't know that I can respond to people on the fly. And it's just I'm not really like, public debate is not my thing. I've taken debate in school and it's just not something I enjoy. And really, it's not me. And so they asked me like a couple more times. And finally, I think it might have been Don again, who was just like, what if we had a couple other people on with you instead of just you and someone else too? And I was like, yeah, I don't know. And come on. So I finally agreed to do it once. And so I get on there and I did it once with, I think it was like a three-host show, one of a few with more than, you know, two people. And after that, they just started notifying me of me being on the schedule. So it wasn't like a question of, are you going to keep doing this? It was just like, hey, you're scheduled for whatever. And I was like, I guess I'm on the show. And that's kind of how I remember it. I don't know if anybody would remember it differently, but that's my recollection of how I ended up on The Atheist Experience.
All right. Kitch, you've got a question from the chat room.
Yes, I have a question from the Polymath44. He wanted to ask about the psychology of religion, of religious belief, and how pastors influence their congregations.
How pastors what their congregations?
Influence.
I didn't catch that word.
Oh, influence. Oh, sorry. Influence their congregations.
Got it. All right. There, yeah, it's cutting out just a little. All right, so he's asking about the psychology of religion and how pastors influence their, like, the flock.
Yeah, that was a question.
That's a big question. I'm not a psychologist. I've read, like, Jung's Psychology of Religion. That's obviously some dated material there. He had the idea that it was sort of that internal dialogue, you know, with the self that got confused a lot of times with God. And as far as how a pastor influences, I think that just has to do with the dynamic of the church. I mean, the church where I went to, there would be times where the flock, for example, didn't agree with what the preacher was starting to preach, and he'd be gone. So it's not like, but there's other churches where definitely they're, you know, around a cult of personality where you've got a pastor like Pat Robertson who is dictating the stuff and, you know, people are there because of that preacher. So it's, I don't think that it's necessarily about, I don't think that it can be like homogenized into this is how it works. I think it's every church is different. You know, like where I went to church, you didn't have to have any sort of formal training to be a preacher. There's other churches where they look for, you know, formal degrees in theology or, you know, people who have graduated from Christian colleges, things like that. So that's, I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's kind of a weak answer, but I'm not really qualified to talk about the psychology of religion or why, you know, why there is, it's such a broadly worded thing. I'm not even sure quite what the question would be.
Okay, Womble, you have a question from the chat room, and then after this, we've got a caller waiting on the line.
Yeah, I think it was asked by Monkey Wallitzer, who has been entertaining us in chat. The question was, how is proselytizing for atheism different than doing it for Christianity?
Well, one of the differences that I encounter is that when I was a Christian who was proselytizing, I was generally introducing information to people who really didn't have mostly like a point of reference. So you're just walking up to somebody, hey, have you heard about Jesus? And no, I don't really know much about it. And so you're telling them stuff and they don't really have many opinions on it, probably. And, you know, either people weren't interested or they were, but you didn't get they didn't have like a cosmology that was already predetermined. So you were just addressing somebody who had very little opinions and you didn't biblical knowledge unless they were raised in some other religion. When you proselytize for atheism, what you run into is that you have to break down an entire meme before you can get to the real person's brain. So at first you're arguing with what I call the meme. So you've got all these apologetics that the person has been indoctrinated with that you have to hit and break down one at a time before you can actually get to the person. So they've got these scripts they've been taught from the time they were, and to the person that's indoctrinated, it feels like their own thoughts, but it's really not. It's these pre-taught scripts drilled into your head to the point that you don't even remember that this was taught to you. You think it's a thought that you're thinking, but really it's a thought that you were taught. And so there's a difference between talking to the meme and talking to the person. When you're hitting these apologetics, you know you've got to the person. When you stop getting these scripted responses and finally the person has to start thinking about how they answer you, like, how do I answer that, what I don't know. And once you get them to finally stop giving you the scripted answers and start giving you real personal, this is what I think, then you've like kind of hit a real human being. You've broken through that meme person. And so that to me is the difference that I encountered between, you know, I always felt like I was talking to a real person when I was proselytizing from Christianity, but as an atheist proselytizing for atheism, I feel like I have to break down almost, what do you call that when you deprogram someone, I have to break down this weird cultish, facade that has been grown that the person doesn't even realize is there before I can actually get to the human being inside.
Okay, I think, Ali, you had a question there.
Yeah, it's more of a comment, actually. Basically, this kind of relativism is a bit troubling for me, because if let's say somebody was out there pushing some sort of pseudoscience medicine or something like that, to say that somebody who goes out and does an awareness campaign about how harmful this stuff is and things like that is similar to the person who's out there pushing and advertising the pseudoscience. I think that really you've got to look at religion in that way. We're not really proselytizing atheism as much as we're trying to raise awareness on the harmful effects and the deleterious effects of the religion. And we're not, I mean, also another thing I notice is that atheists are never really out there on the door knocking at people or out on the middle of the street handing out flyers. It's more that we put the information out there and people who are looking for information can go in and find that information. I've never been ever stopped by an atheist who's, told me, have you heard the good news yet? However, I have been stopped by tons of Christians of all stripes, Muslims, and they come into your house. They come and knock on your door. They, and all this other stuff, rather than where we just kind of put out the information and people who are facing questions about these things can go in and find this information. It's very similar to people who put out information about homeopathy, right? They're not out advertising for homeopathic medicine. They're not out trying to get the patients to take this type of bad medicine. But they put out the information letting people know, and people who get advertisements for homeopathy can then go online and say, is homeopathy real, and get all the information that they need for debunking that kind of thing. And so I'm not really sure that this has anything to do with reality. I think that we've got to look at things in a less relativistic way, because we don't actually have anything that we're pushing. We're just giving them information about the thing that they're being, that's being pushed on them. And so I think that there's a big difference there. I don't. Yeah, go ahead. That's actually all I have to say.
I just want to like comment.
Let Tracy respond.
Oh, that's all right. No, Kitch can go ahead.
All right, Kitch.
Okay, it's just really a quick comment that the promoting of positive atheism is more of a reaction to the religious disinformation on atheism, you know, that can't be good people and stuff like that. Promoting positive atheism is more of a reaction to counter that misinformation, that we can be good people without God. That's all I have to say.
Okay. I was just going to say that I agree with what Ali's saying is about the more proactive nature of proselytizing for Christianity, for example. I'll use that because that's what I was a Christian, but It's true. I mean, people will send us letters to the Atheist Experience and say, why are you bothering people about their beliefs? And we say, our phones don't call out. Like, the studio phones are not capable of an outgoing call. So anybody who contacts the show has called us. Sure, we're available, and sure, we invite the calls, and we're happy to have them, but nobody calls that isn't interested in calling us. So people call us for whatever reasons they want to call us and engage us. We invite that engagement, but we certainly don't go and we don't call anybody else and say, hey, we're calling you. Please explain your beliefs to us. And I do find that a lot of our letters revolve around how do I handle this or that situation when this comes up and it conflicts with my atheism. And like, I'm at a funeral and people are saying things that, you know, I'm really disagreeing with. And, you know, do I just say nothing? And so I do find that skeptics are far more cautious, and I know it's a generality. Some of them are just, you know, whatever, go put it out there. And there's been some that I've, you know, heard situations where I'm just like, well, that's obnoxious and nobody should be doing that. But in general, I do think that the skeptics that contact us or the atheists that contact us are very concerned about not wanting to be offensive and saying, you know, I didn't know if it was appropriate and I didn't say anything. Was that a problem? Should I have said something? Whereas when I was a Christian, it was just go out there and say it, you know, go out there and make sure everybody hears it. And you go up and tell them that, and you're doing them a favor. And even though I think I'm doing people more of a favor now, as, you know, as an atheist who talks about atheism, I feel like I give people their lives back. When I was a Christian, I was trying to get them to give their lives over to a God that I don't believe exists now. And as an atheist, I'm saying, please let me help you get your life back. But I still am not nearly as obnoxious as I was as a Christian.
Plus, I mean, you also, again, I just want to make sure that we don't hand anybody a pamphlet about atheism. We just give them information about the pseudoscience. We don't have anything that we're promoting. We're just letting them know about information about the problems with the things that they're doing. We don't really have anything to sell them. Right.
Correct.
When you say proselytizing, that means you've got something that you're selling somebody. Where we're doing is just giving them information about the pseudoscience that they're involved with. We don't then go and give them something else that they need to follow. We just tell them, hey,
look,
there are problems there. That's it. There's nothing else that comes after that. Even when
it's kind of like that. There's the surgery analogy that's been used a lot, where somebody says, if I remove the cancer, does it mean I have to put something back? And that's the thing. It's like when you help somebody get out of these cults, it's not really, there isn't a need to supply them something else. I mean, and to me, that we very rarely get contacted by people who have left religion who say, I feel like I lack purpose now. I don't even know what to do with my life anymore. That's a few and far between, but it happens. And when we get those letters, it breaks my heart, because I realize just how bereft the religion has left this person of their sense of self and the sense of purpose in their life. I mean, it has stolen everything from them to the point that now that the religion's gone, they feel like they don't even know where to turn or what to do. That's how crippled it has made them as a human being, and that just kills me.
Okay, I think we can go to the caller who's been very patiently waiting. Are you there, Philip?
Hi, is my sound okay? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. So it's
Philip
in Austria.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question is, basically, am I allowed to talk to people and tell them that their beliefs are totally wrong? Because this question comes from a discussion with a friend of mine who studies philosophy. And he has the argument that everybody has his or her own reality. So just because in my reality there is no God doesn't mean that in somebody else's reality there is a God. And I'm not allowed to tell them that my reality is better than theirs. So what about that?
My question would be, what's stopping you? When someone says you're not allowed, I mean, what in the world would stop you?
Yeah, mostly people think it's basically rude to destroy their beliefs. And for most people, I think religion and their belief in the God is kind of a for the fuzzy and warm feeling and like the fear of death or anything to get over with it?
I'm going to tell you something, Philip. When I was a Christian, right, I encountered a lot of people who challenged me in different ways as I got older. And some of those people were extremely rude, like in the way they challenged me. They were right in my face and very ugly. And you know that my response today is to thank every one of those people, even the rudest ones, because they were trying to help me. And they were trying to get me out of something that was harming me. And they were giving me my life back. And if it galled them that I was this walking, talking, spouting meme, I can't blame them, because I look back and I say, wow, I was obnoxious. If you, certainly time and place matters. You know, I've been to parties, for example, at friends' homes where somebody starts talking crap, astrology or whatever you want to plug in, just garbage. And I say to myself, this is not my home. This is their home. It's a party and I need to go find another conversation. And so I just go and find another conversation, because I am not going to get into a dispute with one of their friends within their home at a social event. But, you know, if somebody's talking to me about what they believe and they're volunteering it in a situation where I don't feel like, you know, it's like a public place or the college campus or, you know, hell yeah, I can talk to them about what they believe. They brought it up. How do I know what they believe if they're not telling me? And if they're telling me, that's an invitation for my opinion. So it depends on the time and place, but I don't think that it's wrong to simply question what someone believes, and I think that it's really sad for somebody studying philosophy to say it's wrong to question beliefs.
Yeah, and it's kind of in my – I also have the problem in my family now. My sister got a baby now. She had a baby, and she wants to raise her Catholic, and I was raised Catholic too. I left the religion. And that's the reason why I'm the one bringing up the topic of religion and telling them that it's wrong. So is it okay to just like kind of everybody tells me, you know, because most of the people I know are just religious, and everybody is telling me that I'm rude and it's unpolite to tell people to destroy their worldview. So I don't know what to do. I'm just informing them about the misinformation.
I understand. You're saying this is a family thing. Your sister has a kid. They're going to raise it religious, and that bothers you. And should you say something? Yeah. And so when you say something, they're saying you're rude. And here's the reality. People have a right to associate with whom they want to associate. They have a right to have conversations they want to have, and to say they're not going to have conversations they're not going to have. In other words, if you start to talk to me about something and I tell you, Philip, I am not talking to you about this, you have to respect that. So if your sister is open to these conversations and willing to have them, then have them. If she has told you, I don't want to talk about this and I don't want to hear this from you anymore, then you have to respect that.
Yeah, okay. And I have a little add-on to the question of when it comes so far that people actually have a discourse with me about religion, I realize that most of the times, at a certain point, they start being dishonest about their beliefs. They say something like, oh, that's not what Christianity is about, or that's not what I believe in. And I think that I really want to know, is it just because they see that they realize that their religion or their belief is flawed, and they start being dishonest because they just want to keep it alive and just want... don't lose their religion, or is it just dishonesty? I don't know. It's really weird I never ended a discussion. You know, it was never a point where just a discussion was over and a party won the discussion. Kind of, it's always like they're pissed off and they go away.
Well, there's a couple different possibilities. When you talk to somebody and they're saying, "I don't believe this," and you're thinking, "Yeah, I think you do because of other things you've said before." First of all, anybody can have inconsistent beliefs and not realize it. I've had people point out to me something where I'm just like, oh my gosh, you're right, I did do that before, and now I'm saying don't do that. And it's like, yeah, you know, I didn't equate those things, but somebody helps me put them together. So it's a possibility. I have seen people lie. I've seen people get cornered and just throw down a bald-faced lie in order to have something to say, in order to get out of a situation where they're not comfortable. I've also had I've also been in situations myself where I don't think, this is part of what indoctrination does to you. Anybody can do this, but indoctrination makes you do it a lot. There's been times when I was talking to people in religious discussion when I was a Christian where there was information I was fully aware of. But when I was arguing for something else, that information almost, it just did not get into my head. And so when somebody would point it out, I would almost feel stupid. Like, I knew that. Why didn't I put these things together? Because I already knew this. So if I knew this, why am I saying this? Because it conflicts, and I know the first thing is a fact. So how did I not put that together? Sometimes when a person gets led off down this weird path in religion, they're doing these scripts, and some of these scripts conflict, but they've learned not to put them together. So when you, for example, sit down with a Christian and read the Gospels, like the resurrection section in any of the, I think there's three Gospels that recount it, and when you read that resurrection section to them from one book, they'll say, yeah, I believe it. And then you go to the next book and you read the story, and yeah, I believe it. And then you go to the next book and you read the story, yeah, I believe it. Then you put those books all together and you say, look at these stories, they don't align, how can you believe them all? Now, there's apologetic attempts to reconcile these stories that are extremely convoluted, but I guarantee you most Christians have never seen those apologetics. And so what most Christians are really doing is believing this book, believing the next book, believing the next book, and not ever looking at the books together to see they don't make sense together. So you end up with a situation where the person has simply been taught not to connect certain ideas that conflict. And so from your perspective, looking at it, you're saying, well, how can you believe this and say you don't believe this other thing that has to go together? And in their heads, they're never looking at those two things side by side. They are kept very separate.
So, yeah, I totally agree with that. That's absolutely true. And I think most people didn't think about their beliefs as a whole in most discussions I have with them. But what about people like William Lane Craig and other professional theologians? In those discussions, yeah. There, I'm just thinking, he's the guy, he's totally dishonest. He's always just talking about one very, very, very little tiny bit. And as a matter of fact, you know, religion is not like one argument. It's a whole set of flawed arguments, because there's so many absolutes that just don't fit together, but they always just pick this one little tiny argument and then they just stick with it and try to get it somewhere over to be true. But I really think he's dishonest. I mean, there's just no other way. He's just professionally dishonest.
It's very weird, though. I mean, it is dishonest, I agree, and it's very weird because there are some people, though, there's different types of dishonesty. So you have to, what's happening is there are some people I think that simply don't believe in religion and they use religion to make money. And they're lying to people outright just because they know they can, you know, get on the dole by lying to people about religion, saying they believe it, and then they get a flock and they start raking in the money. I don't think that, and boy, I can't speak to someone's motive, but there's other people, and I'm guessing that William Lane Craig and probably the guy that was like the big deal when I was younger was Josh McDowell, and it's the same type of thing. I think they believe it, but I think that they almost feel like it's okay to withhold certain information for God. And I remember when I was studying about the Bible origins, the person I thought had taught me everything I knew was Josh McDowell and his course studies. And Josh McDowell was able to speak in an informed way on sufficient information for me to know that he was aware of other information that he did not bring up that was detrimental to his arguments. So I know that Josh McDowell could not have uncovered the information he did without uncovering the information that would have impacted his arguments negatively, and yet he never brought up that information and made sure that no one was aware of it because he was trying to say, I'm informing you and you don't need to look it up because here's the information you need. And he always withheld the information that was, you know, harmful to his arguments. I don't think he didn't believe. I think he was, like, probably extremely theistic. And I think that sometimes people get, and I've seen this in other causes too, not just religion, where people get so like involved in a cause that they're willing to lie. I believe that I had such a conversation recently with somebody who is just into a particular, two people in fact, into a particular something so much that they think that it's okay to be dishonest about it just because you're promoting a good cause. It's very sad that people get that into it, but they do.
Okay. Is that your questions, Phil?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right.
Sure. Thank you.
Was nice. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
I have a quick question. Just want to ask Tracy.
Yep. Sure. Go ahead.
Grant, I just want to ask, what was the worst call you ever had on the ATX experience, and what was your favorite?
My worst call?
I don't know if I had a worst. What I mean by worst call, what was the call that just made you lose hope in humanity, if that makes sense? The most stupid call.
I think with me, when we get a call, the one that I think of immediately is one I hung up on, and I'm loath to even mention the name because the person is kind of like a stalkerish when it comes to podcasts and things once he gets a hold of them. And so I don't want to bring it up on your show, but there was somebody that I did hang up on one time because they were making a particularly horrible argument from, you know, an anti-gay thing. It was an atheist who was arguing anti-gay. And he's just a very sad individual that needs to, in my opinion, get a life. And I got so frustrated immediately when I realized that he was just simply being ridiculous. Not that he was being trolling. I mean, I think he might actually believe what he was saying, but to me, it was so stupid. There was just no point to the call, and he was just an idiot. And so I hung up the phone on that one. But it doesn't make me lose faith in humanity because I feel like he's an idiot in the eyes of most people. I don't think there was anybody that, you know, if there had been a big rush of people to defend him as being an intelligent caller, I think I would have been like, oh, my goodness, you know, this is – now I've lost faith in humanity. But knowing that other people are probably watching it and thinking, what an idiot, I think that's probably how they view it. The best call – I've had a lot of good calls. I don't know if there's a best. I felt really good about that last call that actually got a lot of press. But whether or not it was like the best call I've had, I mean, I've had some really good ones. I always like any call that generates public dialogue. So anybody that calls in that actually gets like a, you know, some good conversation going, in my opinion, is a good call. When a call just kind of gets chuckles and lulls, you know, it's cute and it's entertaining, but it's a waste kind of a call. The show should be about generating discussion.
Okay, and I think, Mortimer, you had a question as well.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about invisible dice.
Oh, okay.
That was that.
Which one?
Analogy.
The invisible dice or the empty? Is it the empty jar or the jar with the dice? Which one?
Yeah, well, the whole thing. the thing is, I'm a high school teacher, and I did both my bachelor's and master's theses on the subject of using analogies in science education. So I really like analogies, if I put it that way. And I thought that was a really great analogy. I'd like to hear where it came from.
I was actually going to offer that up, so I will answer your question. It was a real-time demonstration of Carl Sagan's Dragon in My Garage essay.
Oh.
Yeah, it was the demonstration of what Sagan was trying to write. Some people get things more visually when they're demonstrated, and some people get things when they read them. There's a lot of people who can read Sagan's essay and they get done with it, and you start talking to them and you realize they don't understand what they just read. They say they understand it, but they really don't. They sort of miss the principle involved. And so the dice was a way to say you have to have some way to determine what you're talking about from nothing. And if you can't, then there's no reason to say that it's something. If in the end what you're describing, like Sagan said, what is the difference between an invisible, incorporeal, floating dragon that spits heatless fire and no dragon at all? There
exactly.
is no difference. So that was what that was.
Yeah. So I thought it was really really great because you actually did bring you didn't just say that imagine you have three jars
Yeah, there they were.
You actually had the jars there. It was really visual and audible as well, which was horribly annoying, by the way. But
well, it was a really good model on a lot of levels. And I think Matt actually demonstrated that with a lot of the things when he took the jar and said, hey, here's what else you can do with this. And it just kind of showed that there's like amazing numbers of things you can do with this model. I mean, we also, I think, during that show talked about the idea of throwing the dice all over the table and saying, wow, what are the odds that all these dice would have just landed how they did? You know, I mean, look at that. How can you, when you know the odds that each of these dice would have landed on this table just where they land, I think we had something like 20 dice or something like that, and dropped them out of the jar, basically saying, wow, what are the odds they would hit just like that, like where they are? And explaining that why it's irrelevant unless you had this pre-planned. It was like if I had had a chart on the table with the positions of all those dice and also, you know, how they would land as far as face up, face down, you know, front ways, back ways, and then we threw the dice down and they landed exactly where that chart dictated, that would be pretty crazy. But to just see the dice fall wherever they fall and say, oh my gosh, what are the odds that the dice would have fallen this way? Well, the odds are astronomical that the dice would have fallen that way, but so what? It was still really random.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to take a second to introduce our latecomer, Lundy. Lundy?
Greetings, everybody.
Yeah, there you are. Welcome to the show, Lundy. Do you have a question for Tracy?
A very specific question. I'm fairly certain you have asked several of the questions that I would already have in mind. I mean, there's the what's your favorite call. There's the I'm fairly certain you guys have already been over her journey to atheism.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. Very sorry that I showed up late. I thought the show with you was going to be next week. This is my bad. I think what I would ask is, when you are reading sort of an apologetics book, not by Josh McDowell or William Lane Craig, but do you get the distinct impression that what's being done is arguments are being taken that have been used all throughout history, and just there's kind of just a modern face painted on the arguments. Like they don't take into account any of the refutations that have been thrown at these arguments over time, like the ontological argument in Hume, like the Kalam argument, and the many people who have refuted that. They tend to ignore all of those refutations and still present these arguments as if there's absolutely nothing wrong with them.
I don't even think they put that much of a new facade on them. I think they just represent them. They put it in their own words, but it's the same arguments. And I don't think, even with Kalam, I don't even think that the addition of things that begin to exist really adds anything to it. I mean, to me, as far as the rebuttals go, it doesn't change a thing. And I think that it's to the skeptic's advantage that these apologists refuse to, and this is when you're talking about not Josh McDowell, but this is exactly what Josh McDowell did, the idea of you leave out whatever is detrimental to your argument, you only present your argument and the information that will allow for confirmation bias. So Josh McDowell puts in the historical information supporting what he's saying, he leaves out the historical information that would detract from what he's saying. And in the same way, what you're saying is, these people are putting out this argument that they've read. If they've researched these arguments in antiquity, you know they've seen the rebuttals, because part of the apologetic was built upon, you know, responding to these rebuttals and these dialogues that were going on. So there's no way that they researched this historically and never saw the responses. But yet in the book, they just put forward the apologetic again. And I think part of the reason is they're writing these books for affirmation purposes to sell to Christians and people who already believe. I shouldn't just say Christians, because apologetic arguments for God could apply to any religion. But when they're writing these books, they're writing it to sell to people that already believe it. I don't think that they're trying to convince people, really, that there is a God. It's just a mechanism to say, my belief is reasonable because this is reasonable. And it's ironic that with most theists, when you talk to them, if you were to say, if I could demonstrate this argument is problematic, would you quit believing in God? And generally the answer is no, which means that any attempt to show you that it's an unreasonable position is futile. Why should I even waste the time if it's not going to impact your belief? But with these books, the advantage to them giving the believer these books is that, again, it's a script. So the theist looks at the book and they get the script. It's like, okay, here's the cosmological argument script, and this is what I believe. Right? They're reading it and memorizing what they believe. Let me see here what it is that I believe. Okay, I believe this. And so this is what I believe, and this is why I believe it. Thank you, William Lane Craig, for telling me what I believe and why I believe it. And when they run into a skeptic, the skeptic has the advantage of poking the holes and looking at the problems in the argument that William Lane Craig didn't give them, or that any other apologist didn't give them. And so they're thinking, this is reasonable, it makes sense to me, this is why I believe, and then they go and start talking to somebody that doesn't buy into it, and they're just like, well, what about this problem with it, and what about that problem with it, and they've never heard this before. A lot of times what they have heard, though, is straw men versions of whatever you're going to put back to them. So part of the problem in communicating with them is getting them to actually hear what you're saying, because they interpret whatever you say into the straw man they've been taught. So you'll say X and they hear X straw man, and you're like, no, no, that's not quite what I'm saying. I'm saying X, and they hear X straw man. And you're like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying X. And I remember one dialogue, and this is one of those other moments that I'll never forget, where I was actually on a thread. It was an exchange on a thread where I was, you know, typing my arguments, and someone kept telling me that I was saying something, and I remember just, you know, repeatedly saying, that's not what I'm saying. I have not said that. I don't believe that. This is what I'm saying. And I would repeat what I was actually saying. And I did this to him several times, and every time he responded, he kept responding to the straw man version of it, even when I was clearly saying that you are wrong, that is not what I'm saying. And finally, I just posted and I said, I am not saying this. Clearly you think I'm saying this. Can you please go back through my arguments and pull the section where you think I said this and let me know what it is you're not understanding? And when he wrote back to me, I was floored, because what he said was, oh, you're a tricky debater, because I went back and looked and I couldn't find it. And I'm like, and I am responsible for this? Like, how am I responsible for the fact that you kept mischaracterizing my argument repeatedly and I kept correcting you and you kept ignoring me? But the problem was, I was supposed to be saying, because that's my script, right? So he's supposed to say A and I'm supposed to say B. And so when I say not quite B, that is similar enough for him to think I'm saying B, and I say, but no, 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 there's a subtle difference, but it's an important difference. It's this, you know, response. He still keeps hearing B, because that's what he's been told you're going to say to him. And so you have to actually work to break down the straw man portion of that meme that goes along with his apologetic, that, oh, this is what they'll say, but this is, you know, here's the problem with what they're saying. And so he's just responding to a straw man over and over. And you sometimes have to just grab him by the collar and stop him and say, stop, I am not saying this. Listen to me. This is what I'm saying. And like the caller that was on the last time I was on, I don't know how many times I had to repeat to him, how are you making a moral assessment of your God's, you know, goodness? And he would answer something about, he was like, it's not a moral assessment. And I'm like, you're saying he's morally good. It is a moral assessment. How are you making a moral assessment of your God's goodness if you cannot trust your moral judgment? Well, I'm not saying that, you know, God is morally good. It's like, yes, you are. You're saying that he is the basis for your morality. You're saying that you accept it because he is good and you are not. How are you making that moral assessment? I mean, literally, I think it eventually ended up with him just locking up, like his brain just locked up. But you have to keep repeating it because they don't see the problem. It's like, you cannot make a moral assessment of your God as good if you cannot morally assess things. That shouldn't even be hard. And yet, I had to keep repeating it, and he kept giving me answers that did not respond to that question. And because there's no response, it's impossible. You can't make a moral assessment of God as good if you're unable to morally assess. You know, they want to use the you can't make moral assessment so that they can say you can't call God evil because you don't understand God, because you're morally, you know, human and it's faulty. But if you tell them, well, then you can't call God good because you can't make a moral assessment. And, I mean, then all of a sudden they don't understand that. Suddenly it doesn't work that way. It only works, it's only supposed to work the one way, right? But it works either way. If you can't make a moral assessment, you can't know it's good. And so to obey it is immoral because you don't know that what you're doing is good. And he did not understand that. It was extremely difficult to finally get him to understand the problem. And when he did understand the problem, he didn't know how to respond to it.
That actually is a good segue to another question that I had, but we have another caller, so I'll keep that on hold for now. Jay, welcome to the show. Do you have a question for Tracy?
Hi, Tracy.
Hi.
I like your show, and especially there is episode about that guy with his sick dog. And I like your kindness to treat with his questions about his dog, even if it's not related to the program. So thank you.
Well, thank you for that. I'm very glad that you liked my response.
I want to talk about moral and children. The caller is Philip, I think so. He's so worried about his sister's opinion. But my question is, the children should be our responsibility as human beings, because children they are not have any voice to raise. So it is not our responsibility as atheists or humanists or seculars to be the voice of children?
Yes, and I don't have any objection to Philip, for example, talking to his sister. I think my point to him, though, is that when you're having a conversation with anybody, at the point they say, I'm not willing to talk to you about this anymore, you have to stop. Otherwise, you're harassing them.
No, I could...
If I could, real quick, I just want to give a personal example of what's going on here. I have a stepbrother, and he visits me every once in a while. My parents bring my stepbrother and my stepsister over when they're working so I can babysit them. He walked up to me one day and he said, I would like to ask you why it is you don't believe in God. And I was a little thrown off by this because my stepbrother's only 11 years old. So I didn't know if he was ready to have this conversation. So I asked him, I said, are you sure you want to have this conversation? He said, yes. So you are okay. Are you going to tell a bunch of people about the conversation we're about to have? He said, no. That, by the way, didn't end up happening. He did tell like everyone in the family. But well, I don't blame him. He's only 11. But we had a nice long, like 2-hour conversation as to why it is I don't believe in God. And I didn't change his mind, which is not my goal. He asked me a question of why I don't believe. So I told him my reasons and he said, I think I understand. I still believe. I said, that's fine. Go ahead. I just want you to think about what it is I said today. That's all I want you to do. And that's all I did with him. And I think that's the point of responsibility that we have when someone desires to go into that conversation. If someone doesn't desire to go into that conversation, then I don't think it's really our responsibility to sort of evangelize to them as atheists and say, well, you're a Christian and I want to tell you why I think you're wrong. Especially when they're young or when there are family members that you're trying to establish not an intellectual relationship with solely, but also, you know, a familial relationship. Cause that's not totally necessary to engage with that kind of conversation in a family. So that would be my example of how I look at that kind of situation.
I totally agree with you. I never enforce any information to anyone. But sometimes when the children be in risk from toxic their brains through religions, I cannot help myself to just be in silent because I don't want to bother the adults. My concern is if we have the right word, why we cannot have ability to say the right word in kind way to protect children from harm. This is my concern.
Well, I mean, I think that we do have a right to protect children from harm. Like, for example, where I live, we have something called the Department of Protective Services. So if I had a neighbor who, for example, had a child that was dying and he was refusing to get medical help for that child because he thought he should pray instead, I could report that and he would probably have his child taken away. So, I mean, we can't, and also there are many laws against, you know, body mutilation of children due to religion. I think there could be a few more of those laws. So we do try to protect children from harm, you know, from overt or clear harm. You get into a little bit of a gray area. You know, it's like there are certain things with religion that I think are, for example, abusive, that would be emotionally or mentally abusive, that are a little bit more difficult to demonstrate, and I, you know, and then you get into other areas of things that might be slightly harmful, and are you allowed to do this or that? Can you take your child in and have their ears pierced if the kid doesn't want to do it or they're too small to consent? Can you, I mean, at what point, you know, what rights do parents have as stewards? I like to look at parents as stewards of their children and not owners. And so I would probably restrict parental rights a little bit more than they are currently. But you have to be careful when you talk about what you're teaching your child is harmful because, for example, where I live, there's a whole lot of theists and a whole lot of fundamentalist Christians. And so there might very well have been a time not too long ago when being an open atheist might be cause, like during a divorce, for you to lose custody. Where they would say, you not teaching your child about God is harmful to that child, and so the state is going to grant you very limited visitation of your own kids. So when you're talking about regulating harm based on what the state believes is wrong teaching, you've got to be really, you've got to have some good evidence there. You've got to have some good metrics there that you can actually demonstrate this is hurting the kid. And part of that reason is because when you're not on the top of that rung making the rules, when you're in the 10% minority, what you believe and what you might want to teach or not teach your kid could easily end up on the you're not a good parent list. So you have to be a little wary about where you draw those lines of you're openly hurting your kid and I think I need to stop you.
Thank you, Trace.
Sure.
Thank you. Sorry.
I have one statement before I go. For sake of my friend Abdelaziz, I say this statement to Amir, the Princess of Kuwait. Princess of Kuwait, please, you did a lot of work to put Kuwait in, or to bring Kuwait in the civilization. So please don't destroy Kuwait, by abuse human rights through polysemy law. So please give our friend his freedom because he deserves as a human being and remove polysemy law from everywhere because it is. Polysemy law abuses human rights 100%. Thank you all of you. And thank you, Teresa, and your name to follow to my favorite songular name. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, if everybody goes to Michael Nugent's personal website, I believe he has the petition on there to try and see if we can do something with Aziz over in Kuwait. So if everybody wants to take a look there, I don't have the link on me, but if you Google Michael Nugent, then you can find his blog.
Yeah, I'm just getting the link. I'm fetching the link right now. So there's some audience questions. I'll let Lundy field them.
Actually, I have just a quick question. In America, the separation of church and state has been pretty much been established, but it's constantly under attack. I just want to ask Tracy, just from an outsider point of view, where is the biggest threat to that separation of church and state coming from? What is the biggest battle right now in America?
Well, I would say it's probably the Dominionists who believe that they're responsible for inserting their religion into politics. So, I mean, there's actually a faction of people who think that it's their job to control public policy and drive us, I guess, toward end times prophecy. So they are probably responsible for pushing the idea of involvement, you know, church-state integration. But then there's also, but I don't know if that's the biggest threat. I mean, they're probably the most overt thing threatening. But the biggest threat, in my view, comes from, like, the fallout of Christian apologetic arguments for getting their religion into the state. So what happened is, you know, there was a time when the church basically just said, we have a God-given moral right to be promoting our stuff in school, and we have a God-given moral right to be promoting our stuff, you know, here or there. And as we moved more towards the idea of, you know, separating church and state more clearly, they began to lose in court. And when they started to lose in court, they started to learn and evolve their arguments to understand that they had to come up with some sort of secular veneer to overlay onto their religious argument in order to make up a reason why this isn't religious but is secular and can be inserted into a secular venue that is state-run. So a great example of that was the Dover trial for intelligent design, where in Dover they wanted to, you know, question evolution. They thought that intelligent design should be taught in the schools. They were promoting that it was a scientific view. They even had a scientist that they got on the stand who, you know, got up to promote that intelligent design was science, and he was promoting his idea of the complexity, you know, that couldn't be explained by evolution.
Irreducible complexity.
Yeah, and so irreducible complexity. And so he was up there talking, and ultimately they had a theist judge who ultimately said, no, this is religion, and you're just dressing it up to look like it's secular, but it's not. However, sadly, as a result, you do get secular people who buy into this idea that maybe there is something to the intelligent design concept, and they don't even realize that what they're buying into is sort of a thin veneer of secular speak over a religious claim. And they think that this is secular. Like, they've bought the claim that Dover said is bullshit. These people have actually said, no, it's not crap. I believe it, and it's not religion. And I'm looking at it going, yes, it is. And you've just simply been hoodwinked in the way they hoped that everybody would be hoodwinked, and now you're promoting this as a secular idea, which, sadly, plays right into their hands. And you see this with things like abortion, and you see this with things like I said, intelligent design is like another big one. But they buy into very thin religious arguments that are put forward as a pretense of secular, and they believe these are secular people who sincerely believe that these are secular good arguments and not religious religiously created arguments intended to sell this as secular. You know, it's like an afterthought. They're afterthought arguments, and it's kind of sad to me that. That they are able to garner public support. Like the idea of, should we teach both in schools? When you ask people that, you know, you'll get support from people who are religious and secular saying, yeah, I don't see the problem teaching intelligent design alongside evolution. It's, you know, teach them both. Why not? It's just they don't understand what they're saying. And so they get support from the secular people by pretending that it's not religious.
Yeah, I always feel that the teaching evolution and intelligent design together will be pretty much the same as teaching a round earth together with a flat earth. There's no debate in the scientific community that over evolution. There may be arguments over the specifics, but the overall picture is very clear.
Yeah, if they wanted to change the title of the course and say it's not an earth sciences course, if they wanted to say we're going to call it a course on, you know, cosmologies, you know, comparative cosmologies. Yeah, taste whatever you want in there about what people believe about universal origins, but don't call it science. And then you have to make the, you know, the question is, do we want to teach science or not? And if you don't want to teach science, then, you know, I would be against that. But if that's what's, you know, if publicly they're going to say we're going to stop teaching science because it conflicts with religion, okay, then so be it. And if you want to have a cosmology course where they talk about what science puts forward and why and what religion puts forward and why, have it. But that's not what they're doing. They want to insert this into a course titled Science. It's like, this is not science, so it can't go in there. And if you have a problem with what science is promoting, then you need to question whether or not we want to include science in our school curriculum, or if we need to pull it out because it offends somebody's religion.
We have a few questions from the audience that I'd like to go over before I delve into a question that I actually have. First question we have from Bod2Bits says, if one cannot defeat some people's blind belief through logic and reason, what do you think is the key element of belief that we need to understand to better challenge those kinds of people?
If a person is not amenable to logic and reason, I don't think there's anything you can do. I think you just need to move on to the next person that you actually can reason with. An unreasonable person, I don't know what you would say. What could you possibly... You just have to wait till they die. I mean, I don't know.
There really isn't anything I think you could say.
Well, I think that you could take into account the fact that, for the most part, it's tied up for their identity. And if you can find a way to talk to them... while not making it seem like you attack their identity, may help in a way, because at least from my experience, and this is a completely anecdotal, by the way, obviously I'm not a psychologist or anything, but I find that if you can talk to somebody and explain to them that they're much smarter than this, that all bring it down to personal things, things like, you know, suffering and things like that. I think that these kinds of emotional arguments, while they don't carry any intellectual weight, they can kind of push people who don't really have any intellectual reasons to believe in any of this stuff. So separating it from their identity in conversation and bringing it to a personal and emotional level in a conversation. But if for the most part, I agree that it's pretty much a waste of time.
It's kind of like, it reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever run into somebody that argues this, but there are people who will throw at you that you'll say something about, you know, this isn't reasonable, it doesn't make sense, and you'll throw down like a logical inconsistency, and I've gotten the rebuttal more than once. Well, my God is beyond logic. My God is beyond reason. And my response, I mean, to me, that's a brick wall. And I respond with simply saying, thank you for acknowledging that your God belief is unreasonable and illogical. And I don't know what else to say to you, since you're not amenable to reason or logic, and yet you're admitting your beliefs are not. The issue with it, though, is it only seems to be beyond logic and reason when it's you pointing out there's a logical inconsistency happening. When they want to explain to you why they believe in God, it's just reasonable because, right? They have all these things where it's like, I believe, and you tell them they're not being reasonable in their belief, and they'll sit there and tell you why it's reasonable. And then you hit this point with them where they're like, well, you know, God is beyond reason and logic. And it's like, well, then all of those things you said that you know about God because you reasoned it out, you can't trust. And it's just like the moral argument. How do you assess God's morality if you don't have a working morality? And how do you assess anything about God if you can't reason it out, if it doesn't make any sense? If you say to yourself, well, it makes sense to me that God would be this or that, or I see intelligent design, how could it be intelligent design if God's not amenable to any kind of reason or logic? What you're basically saying is, if for it to be designed, it has to make some kind of sense. Otherwise, how did you determine this? And if you're saying that this God doesn't adhere to sense or reason or logic, how are you able to know anything about this God? Like, how do you understand it? You don't. And so what are you talking about? How can you speak to me and offer anything at all that you can claim to know or believe in a reasonable way about this God? You cannot. You have just undermined your entire reasons for belief.
speaking from another anecdotal standpoint that actually counters, I think, yours, Ellie, I have a friend who fully acknowledges that his belief in a god is not based on any sort of evidence or even logic. It is mainly based solely on what he desires to be true, mainly that he is exceedingly afraid of this life being our only life. He really has a huge emotional problem with that, and he does not want that to be true. So he has created a god, and he's pretty much made up his own rule. He's not even a Christian. I would say that he's sort of, a deist with reincarnation beliefs, mainly. It's a very strange set of beliefs. He's got a sort of a hodgepodge of things going on, but I'm not capable of arguing this with him because if he already acknowledges that there's no evidence for it, he already acknowledges that there's no logic behind it, he already acknowledges that this is totally an emotional thing for him, I'm not sure what I can actually tell him that's going to convince him to abandon his belief that he's made solely as a result of what I find to be an irrational fear. So
I agree. I think that there, for the most part, there really is not much you can do after that. I'm just saying that in some cases, like I've had success where if you can show the person that they're capable of doing horrible things that they can then reflect on later, that's in a very rare case can work. But I agree that for the most part, once somebody is not amenable to reasons and logic and things of that nature, that it's pretty much a hopeless case. I definitely agree with that statement. It may work in some cases where I've had some, for instance, somebody who I've showed them that they are willing to kill because of this, and obviously my experience is mostly with Islam. And a few weeks later, that person has seen that this can turn them into a horrible person, and have given up the religion. But obviously, this is one case out of millions that, you know, obviously it's not gonna, nothing is gonna work. If you're not amenable to reason and logic, then, you know, this is pretty much, it's a hopeless case.
At the very least, that's at least one more person that's not going down a road that leads to danger, not just for them, but for other people. So at least that's good. We have another question from the chat room. Caro would like to ask, in general, just about the Atheist Eve cartoons. I'll see if I can make an actual question out of this. What inspired you to make the Atheist Eve cartoons?
I think what inspired me was just every time I realized something logically inconsistent that I thought of, or things that I had said when I was religious, as I was coming out of it and started having these epiphanies of, oh my God, I can't believe I thought this. I can't believe I argued this. I can't believe I believed this. I can't believe I accepted such a horrible thing, you know, as reality. And all of these things were so horrific once you pull them out of this, you know, the religious structure in which they're insulated. And you start really examining them and you start seeing how it's that you were saying and believing these really awful things about humanity and also believing things that were just not consistent with other beliefs that you were holding. I mean, just the kind of craziness of it all once your head starts to pull out of it and you start really seeing it. And I've had people describe it as feeling like they were coming out of the Matrix and how it was just like, oh my goodness, you know, and you start then seeing it completely differently than you did before. And when you start really looking at it and you're not insulating it with all of these sort of paddings that come with the indoctrination, and it's no longer wrong to question and doubt, and you can actually view what you were doing and what you were saying, what you were believing, the ludicrousy of it all, just made me, I guess I'm the kind of person that laughs at irony, laughs a little bit at pain, you know, I'm the kind of person that can, I guess, laugh at myself. And a lot of the Atheist Eves are me laughing at myself. And that little Christian, I guess, that is one of the characters in the cartoon to some degree reflects me, you know, as well as Atheist Eve reflects me. I think that little Christian is kind of my past self in a lot of ways. There's other times, of course, when, you know, she reflects something that a Christian is telling me. And sometimes I do hear something that I didn't believe personally or I'd never heard before that somebody will say to me, and I'll be like, wow, that's off the rails, and it ends up in an atheist deep. But a lot of times she's just like a little past me, that little girl with the cross around her neck.
That's actually adorable. 27288 asks a question. Not sure how we're going to be able to answer this question because of how it's phrased. The question is, do you think the Bible has authority over the Quran from a theological standpoint, due to the fact that the Bible documents Jesus already existing? And for me, I'm not sure how we would be able to answer this question because we don't believe either of them represent a reality that actually happened for the most part. So,
wait, what was their logic about the Jesus thing?
The Bible documents Jesus already existing, so does that make the Bible have more authority over the Quran?
I don't understand what they mean, documents Jesus already existing. I mean, Jesus is mentioned, I think, as well in the Quran. Isn't he? I mean, Ali would probably be able to speak to that more, but I thought he was a prophet.
I'm not sure if it was the Quran. I think they have it in the Surah where they reference him. Generally, they reference him and the people who follow him as being followers of the little book.
As I understand it, and like I said, somebody that's Muslim can probably talk to this more than me, and so I apologize in advance if I say this wrong, but as I understand it, the Quran is supposed to be, like, the mythology around the Quran is that the prior books, the Christian books and the Hebrew books, were all corrupted through time in their translations and things, and so you can't trust them anymore because they're all translated and edited and, you know, all messed up now. And so the idea was that God sent this angel to come and talk to Muhammad, who the angel kind of cleared it all up and said, here's the real story as it was before it got all bastardized. Do not ever change this book. And this is the real tale. And so according to this, the Bible wouldn't have authority because it's a corrupted book, according to Islam. It's a book you can't trust anymore. And a lot of times when you talk to Muslim apologists, they will point out beautifully errors throughout the text in the Christian Bible. They are fantastic at identifying mistakes and problems in the Christian texts. But they, you know, they of course adopt their own as authoritative and perfect. And I don't think that the Bible would have more authority unless you were a Christian and rejected this later revelation that is supposed to be from the same God.
Yeah, this is precisely the problem with Revelation, is that the Christians say their book is the inerrant word of God, and so do the Muslims, and they both have conflicting stories based solely on Revelation. That conflict with each other. So Tracy nailed it. Basically, the Quran says that all the other books have been bastardized, I'll use your word, and basically the Quran was revealed to Muhammad via the angel Jibreel to correct all the mistakes that were later inserted into the Bible and the Torah and the other books, which are yet to be found. And so basically, if you're a Muslim, the Quran, the Bible has no authority. And if you're a Christian, then the Quran has no authority. And it's completely relative on what revelation you choose to, what you happen to have been born to the parents that believe in. Other than that, there's no objective sense in which one is more authoritative than the other. That you can, from an outside perspective, look and say, oh yeah, the Quran is definitely more authoritative on Jesus. Neither one of them is authoritative from an outside perspective.
We have a caller on the phone, Tenoro, sorry, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. Welcome to the call. Do you have a question for Tracy?
Yes, I did have a question, and it's Tenoro normally. Tracy, I just want to say you are among my favorite hosts on the Atheist Experience. I like the more aggressive hosts too for a different reason, but I like the reasonable arguments too. I sort of categorize you as among the and your dice your dice model is an example of this, how you have you present the reasonable arguments where. I don't want to say something unfair, so let me get past that. And just by saying that you're among my favorite hosts.
Thank you.
And there was a show where you were you did a show with Matt here recently where is one of probably one of the notable shows because it was going around everywhere after it happened when you guys were on the phone with a caller discussing the moral argument, and it ended with Matt spectacularly calling the guy inexplicative and hanging up. Well, first I want if I ever make it down to Austin, I want to buy Matt a drink for that.
He'll probably buy you.
But my question comes down to I see that sort of display, and I think it's fantastic. But at the same time, there was a while back when Aaron Ra had made a point about why it is important not to throw vitriol when confronting a Christian apologist, and has everything to do with at some point later they might be on the same side of the fence as you. And my problem is I am in a lot of ways like Matt in that I try to make a reasonable argument, but I usually end up I shouldn't say usually because he's very civil. Oftentimes I end up just dropping the hammer on the other person, and I always have trouble picking out when that's appropriate.
First of all, let me ask, have you ever seen me kind of put the hammer down on somebody in that way?
I don't think I've ever seen you put the hammer down on somebody.
So then I might not be the best person to answer that question. Well, but let me just say that I'll give you an example. Atheist experience. First of all, if somebody ever does end up on the skeptic side, if somebody deconverts and becomes a skeptic, and they have been told, for example, that they are, you know, a piece of crap for saying that a child who is raped may have been evil, I would hope that they would say, you know what, the person who called me a piece of crap was right, because that statement is something that would come out of a piece of crap, and I was crap for saying it. But I will say, for example, when you talk about the more, energetic hosts on the show, a lot of times Jeff D's name comes up. And when I have a big background in communication, and so when I first started doing the show, I had a real, problem with the idea of this escalation of emotionalism on the program, because I was always taught in communication that once you get to this angry emotional level, reason tends to stop because people start getting defensive, and so it's hard to have a dialogue with a person when you've made them defensive or when you're becoming defensive because you start defending and you quit really communicating. So from a communication standpoint, on a one-on-one discussion, it's a very bad idea to keep talking when you're emotionally driven. However, that being said, with Jeff, when he talks about hell, I remember initially thinking to myself, I don't know why he gets upset, because if you don't believe in hell, why do you care? I mean, it's not like you're really going to go there, so what difference does it make? And the person might believe it, but they're crazy. I mean, you know, it's like crazy in a relative sense, of course, but you know, they may say you're going to burn forever, but you're not, and they're just being silly. So, but later, when I got on the email list, I started to see that the show is really not geared toward the callers. And it's a mistake to think that the show is geared toward the callers. The show is geared toward the audience. And I don't mean the studio audience. I mean anybody that's listening. And what happens is the person on the phone will get very defensive a lot of times. I mean, there's sometimes we get callers that stay very calm and reasonable throughout the call, or calm and, you know, able to be reasoned with throughout the call. But there are also times where somebody gets really defensive and freaks out. And, you know, and so when somebody, once you have those calls, what happens is the person that gets defensive on the other side of the call is not going to be reasoned with. But there are people that are watching who hold the same religious views as the person on the call. And because they're not in that dialogue having to defend it, they have this weird objective sort of dissociation with the argument, and they're able to actually see it and evaluate it without feeling attacked and defensive. So the people who – I don't think I've ever heard anybody write to us and say, I was convinced after calling you that that atheism is correct. But I have seen a lot of letters from people saying, I saw these calls and I would think just like the caller, and then I would hear what are your responses, and it made me realize that that what I believed wasn't making sense. People who are watching see it differently than the people on the phone. And when Jeff brings the hammer down on hell and says this is offensive, he's actually, I think, waking people up. And this is me speaking on his behalf as somebody who has never heard Jeff say this. So bear that in mind. This is my interpretation of what I see from the caller response to Jeff, or from the audience response to Jeff, the letters. People don't – we've heard about hell so much that we don't even really think about it anymore. It's almost like a nobody even, you know, yeah, yeah, hell, you go there when you're bad and blah, blah, blah. And we don't think about the implications of somebody saying, you are such an awful person. I wish you would be, or I hope you would be, or I believe you deserve to be tortured forever in the most horrible way. And when you think about the idea that as a society, you know, and I'm talking, I guess, specifically, even, you know, here in Texas, where we're considered, like, really tough on crime or whatever, and we've got the death penalty, we wouldn't torture somebody. You know, I mean, we wouldn't torture somebody 5 minutes. It would be illegal for law enforcement to torture someone. I mean, not to say that horrible things don't happen, but it's not legal. It doesn't occur legally. If a police officer or somebody in a prison, you know, a prison ward, were to be discovered torturing someone, that would be illegal and there would be problems with that. We certainly don't torture them as a legitimate form of punishment, for any sort of crimes. And so you have to ask yourself, if somebody like Ted Bundy, who rapes and kills, you know, 20 different people, doesn't deserve to be tortured, what on earth have you done that would require a penalty of eternal torture? And for somebody to say that they believe that's justified, someone who's talking to you to say that to you, it's like, what on earth have I done that you think deserves this? And it's kind of waking people up, especially Christians don't even think about it. It's like it doesn't even click in their heads that there might be a problem here. I've had them say, well, to God, you know, all the sins are equal. And it's like, okay, so you worship a God who can't tell the difference between, you know, a gay couple and the Holocaust? I mean, really? I mean, how is that even a moral evaluation or a moral judgment? You know, God is so perfectly good that no sin can stand before God. And so everyone deserves to be tortured forever just for being a human being. And you think to yourself, you believe in a God who thinks that you're worthy and your children are worthy, and your mom and dad are worthy, and your siblings are worthy, and everyone you know is worthy to be tortured forever. What on earth could we possibly have done that was that awful? Do you really think that's fair? And I think that's kind of where Jeff is getting at. It's like, would you torture even, you know, somebody for what? What would make you torture a human being? It would take quite a lot for most of us to be willing to torture somebody at all, to have the stomach for something like that, and to believe in a God that thinks you should, you know, be punished forever, and then to say you did it to yourself for being human. Wow, that is such a dehumanizing, evil doctrine. And people just are so used to it, they don't hear it. And so his outrage, I think, is almost like a wake-up, but like an alarm clock, you know, to say, hear what you're saying.
Would that be everything that you have to ask?
Well, that was my only question. I mean, based on everything that you've told me, just to make sure that I'm understanding, what you're essentially trying to say, and I'm trying to summarize a little, just to make sure I understood, is that once you're pretty much convinced that the person you're talking to isn't going to go anywhere themselves, and I'm going to have to oversimplify this, but by saying, but make an emotional appeal and try and wake them up. If not them, everybody else.
I don't know if it's so much an emotional appeal as simply saying, do you understand how reprehensible what you just said is? Like, how if someone else said this to you, I mean, you wouldn't torture somebody, right? So what in the world makes you worship a God who would torture everybody? I mean, what in the world makes you think this is okay? And to just say this is shocking what you believe. And like when that caller called that little girl evil, I mean, it was almost the way he said it was. I've read people on threads talking about that call, and what really saddens me, I added an entry to our blog to explain what I was seeing because it was so appalling to me, and I get so angry at it. Theist will rebut you with statements that are actually confirmations, and they say it as though they have offered a rebuttal. And what's really sad to me is many times skeptics accept it as a rebuttal, and it's like, you know, he didn't rebut you, he just agreed with you, and you didn't point out to him that that's what he did, that he was supporting what you just accused him of. He wasn't arguing against it. And a couple of issues that came up with that had to do with when I said that, you know, your God allows child rape or your God is orchestrating it, one or the other. And there were people on Threads who were saying, no, God doesn't allow child rape. See, people have to have free will. And then they launch into this whole free will thing. And at the end of it, the summary is, and that's why God allows child rape. Okay. So it's like, okay, so you just used a whole lot of words to tell me what I already said, which is you worship a God that allows child rape. Thank you for agreeing. And I don't know what all the other words were for, but you admit that your God allows child rape and you think that's all right. And you think it's justified by whatever the hell else you've got to say. And then there was the idea of the girl being evil. And I saw Christians on Threads saying, well, they hung up on the caller, but if they would have let him talk, he probably would have explained that we're all evil. And we, you know, they go into this whole thing about how we're all born evil and blah, 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 blah. And at the end of it, it's like, so you think the little girl is evil? So why can't you just say, yes, I think the little girl is evil? Why do you have to launch into this like 100-word description of the little girl is evil? It's not a rebuttal. It's a confirmation of what I just said. And I get really tired of them offering confirmations as though they have somehow rebutted it. And then at the end of it, you know, putting it down and saying, and so there you go. Now it's all justified to say that the little girl who's raped is evil, and it's all justified to worship a God that allows children to be raped. It's like, wow, okay, I knew you thought that before. Did you think telling me why was going to make a difference? Yes, I understand you've got your reasons for worshiping a rape-allowing God and your reasons for saying that little children are evil. I'm just saying that in ultimately what's happening is you worship a God that allows child rape and you think that the children are evil that get raped. And I think that's ridiculous. And I can't believe, except that I used to believe these things myself, that you could get a human brain to adopt such awful things.
All right. Well, I had one other very quick question, then I'm going to jump off and let everybody else go. I had a discussion, sort of a topic on general morality. Which of the ACA hosts or other would you say is a good individual to contact and discuss this with?
Discuss?
General morality.
Well, I don't know that there's a good person to discuss it with. I know that Matt has some recorded debates and also some recorded talks on it that you could access. It's a little tough when you get into who can we discuss it with, because we've since we started streaming live on the internet, the mail is insane. So it's not like there's going to be a lot of time for somebody to devote to like a pen pal kind of dialogue. We're really mainly into answering things really quickly, and there it goes. And so if you're looking for like answers to the questions on the moral issues, Matt has material that's already available where he talks about his views on that pretty extensively. So I would look up Matt Dillahunty, you know, plus morality, you know, debate and also lecture and see what you come up with. I know there's links for those.
Plus there are tons of discussion boards like Atheist Nexus and things like that that you can also go to. There's not, you know. Obviously, some people won't. A lot of the people that you're asking are not going to have the time. But if you've really got questions, there are people with time who have good things to say on plenty of discussion boards everywhere.
Yeah, and I would say Austin Klein at atheismabout.com has got amazing, you know, set of articles that he has put together over years and years and years, and that's a fantastic resource, if I can just plug that. It's, you know, Atheism 101. If you're a new atheist, or, I mean, by that I mean like someone who's just, you know, become an atheist and you're looking for information, that's a fantastic site, and he is a fantastic, you know, person putting all that together.
All righty. Well, I'll go ahead and leave the call. I'll be listening in the chat.
All right. Thank you very much for the call.
All right. Thank you. And thanks all of you.
Okay. Thank you.
We do have another question from the chat room, but I've been kind of putting a question on hold, and I want to kind of ask it before I forget, and we don't really have a whole lot of time left. There seems to me, and this is just from my personal perspective, that there is a confusion between when somebody is performing what's known as a reductio ad absurdum on an argument, and when somebody is strawmanning an argument. And that is something that I think is one of the main things that kind of gets in the way of when an argument is trying to be made one way or the other concerning the theist-atheist debate. For instance, when we say concerning your moral argument, Tracy, which is kind of what brought this question to mind, if we are going to go ahead and presume the conclusion that we cannot judge morality, then by default that necessarily means that we also cannot judge God's goodness, because we are incapable of judging morality. Now, a lot of theists look at that and say, that's not what I'm saying, that's a straw man, or that's you're not getting what I'm saying right. But no, what in fact is happening is you're taking the conclusion of their logic to its absurdity, and they don't like it. So, what, like, do you think that's as prevalent a problem as I seem to think it is? Because I think that's a really big one concerning this whole conversation.
I think the problem I have is I don't consider that making it absurd. I think that if they're going to tell me that the reason I can't judge their God as evil when I see what appears to be an evil action is that a human being can't judge God, I think it's extremely fair to say, how have you judged God as good? I mean, they're literally saying, I can't judge God because my morality is broken. And when I ask them about their morality, they say they get it from God because theirs is broken. And I'm like, okay, so you're taking it from God. And I assume that you're making an assumption here that God is giving you good morality and not evil morality. How have you reached that conclusion? That to me is like not making an absurd. I'm not taking their argument to absurdity. I'm asking what I think would be the reasonable question when I'm being told I can't say it's evil because right. He's unjudgeable. It's like, well, how right. Did you say it's good?
Because the reason I say it reduces it to absurdity is mainly because of the notion of taking an argument that they're making and showing that it sort of refutes their own position. That's kind of how I view absurdity within the terms of logic.
Okay. They only want to, though, refute mine. They want to ignore how it impacts
right.
their own position. Correct.
And that's what a reductio ad absurdum does. It says, well, you can go ahead and try and refute mine using that logic, but you're kind of screwing yourself over, too.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood it. I thought it was when you sort of drag somebody's argument to, like, really to absurd proportions, like almost like slippery slope. But maybe I just misunderstand what that is.
Well, no. The reductio ad absurdum is generally a fairly commonly used argumentation tactic used by just about any philosopher or logician that you can think of. It's probably one of the most popular forms. But the problem is that a lot of people mistake what you're doing there for a logical fallacy, like a straw man. Like that's like you're evidently you're not allowed to make inferences based on the logic that someone is using, because then now that's a logical fallacy. But
But I mean, if they're claiming that they're getting good morality from God and they're saying people can't judge God, to me it just seems like, you know, if someone's telling me this, the question that comes into my head is, well, then how did you assess God? I mean, if you have the same broken moral faculties that I have, I don't know how you're making an assessment. Like, how did you figure out God was good without making judgments? I mean, how did you not judge, if you can't judge God as good, if you're not looking at what you think is evidence that demonstrates God is good and then making a moral assessment with your moral judgment that it is in fact evidence that God is good and so he is therefore trustworthy as a, you know, like the arbiter of morality or whatever, and then why can't I look at it, see things that I think are evil and say that looks really evil to me and I think that God is evil? I mean, but when, you know, I don't know. To me, it just seems very like the natural question that would come up.
So moving on from that, we have the next question from Bod2Bits again. Where do you see religion in the USA in about 50 years' time?
Boy, that's, you know, if I had a crystal ball, I don't know. I have no idea. I think that, you know, you've got current trends and you can say to yourself, well, if the current trends continue, clearly I think that attitudes even among religious people are changing in a more liberal direction currently. Like you have a lot more religious people that are starting to open up the doors to mm-hmm. gay couples and be okay with that and stop, you know, condemning it. And you also have them being more, I mean, when I was younger, You single mom was no, you never saw that. And that was just, you see, we were starting to see people, women that were divorced, and it was just, you know, scandalous or whatever. And and today it's just very common. People accept it. You'll see lots of divorced people in churches, lots of single parents in churches, and it's just, they have really, really liberalized in a big way. Part of the problem, well, it's not a problem, it's I guess just an expected consequence of that, is that the churches that are more and more, you know, more conservative in their bent, are kind of digging in that much deeper and starting to work that much harder. And because a lot of what they do is not publicized as religious, as I mentioned earlier, they have a way of sort of shrouding themselves in secular, you know, sheep's clothing, when they come out into the public to talk about their issues. A lot of people don't even understand that religious agendas are being promoted, because they see them as secular, because that's how they're presented, because the churches that promote them are smart enough to know that you can't just come out and call it religious. So these conservative churches are promoting their agendas in ways that are not openly religious, and they are ramping it up. I think there was like so much more legislation in the last 4 years to restrict women's reproductive rights, and they're defunding Planned Parenthood. And so, even though I believe, there is no evidence to show, by the way, that when in the polls that people oppose choice, the majority of people still seem to be pro-choice when it comes to allowing somebody to make their own decisions about their reproduction. And yet, they are successfully defunding Planned Parenthood. They are successfully, well, and sometimes unsuccessfully, I'll give them that. You know, a lot of that legislation did get knocked down. So, but I mean, they're putting forward this legislation. They're really ramping up. They're really promoting these religious agendas. And a lot of this stuff isn't getting seen. You know, people just aren't aware of it. And so it kind of slips under the radar, but that's despite the fact that more and more religious people seem to be getting more liberal. Churches are kind of getting away from this biblical, you know, literalism. And so I think, I would say that probably, I don't know about 50 years, but I think in the next 100 years, a person born like at the beginning of this century, or the beginning of the century, probably wouldn't, or born when I was born, probably wouldn't recognize the Christian church. I think it's going to change to a degree that it wouldn't even be what I would have thought of as Christianity anymore. And I think that the church is going to morph into something different and liberal if it continues in the trends that it's on. And I also think that secularism is going to rise if it continues on the trends that it's on. And I think that the people who are currently having like a really conservative backlash to that are just going to dwindle to smaller and smaller numbers. And you know, I would hope that they would become an irrelevancy in the public arena. But again, this is just if it keeps going the way it seems to be going.
All right. Do we have any more questions from the audience? I don't think we do.
Any panel questions at all? If anyone wants to chime in?
None really comes to mind for me. Marty,
no,
Kitch, anybody? Okay. Well, we do only have about 4 minutes left in the show anyway, as far as I'm concerned. Right, Zula, we're doing the two-hour thing?
Yes, we are.
Okay, so we have about 4 minutes left in the show. So I think right now we'll just say firstly, thank you to Tracy for coming onto the show, and thank you for mentioning it on the Atheist Experience and getting us a little more traffic than we're used to.
Yes.
81 viewers instead of the usual, like, 20.
I've got a quick thing to say before we close. Just remembered. Okay. And it's really bad that I've actually only just remembered. I should remember this from the start. Skeptic TV is back on the 2nd of February. We'll be doing our twice weekly show on there, and I think we've sorted it so that we're in your off weeks.
Okay. And can you tell us what your first show is going to be? Any?
I think we are possibly, and this is me pulling from memory, I've not been checking our forums today, possibly something on climate change.
Oh, cool. So that'll be Colin nice and riled up for that one.
I think he's got something special lined up. He hasn't really told us, but he's been chuckling into his clogs about something for the last sort of couple of weeks about what he's got planned for us kicking off the year.
Real quick before we close out, I have a question from somebody in the audience. Real quick, they wanted to ask Tracy if you've ever seen the video "Burn Victims" by the Thinking Atheist.
Amazing.
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, I suppose you probably, I'm getting the inference that he would probably recommend that video. I'll go ahead and try and find it for everybody in the chat room here real quick.
Yeah.
So the video is called Burn Victims. It's by a Thinking Atheist who runs another podcast called The Thinking Atheist, where he regularly interviews people. He has also interviewed, I believe, Matt Dillahunty and Aaron Raw at certain times. Fairly well done podcast. Freaking YouTube is being slow. trying to fill up the time while I'm looking for the video.
All right. Yeah, I was just going to say we are back same time next week, and we have Dr. Daryl Ray joining us. I think you know him quite well, Tracy.
Well, I know him a bit, yeah.
All right, well, he's been on your show quite a bit, so yeah. But we're really looking forward to having him on. So have you got that ready, Lundy?
Yep, I got it pulled up. Okay. I'll go ahead and link it for everybody in the chat, and I'll go ahead and link it in the Skype conversation as well. Right. So there's that from us.
And we'll give Ali a quick word as well, because, like I say, he's got something important to talk about.
There we go.
Yep, I would just like to remind everybody once again that we really do need as much help as we can about making noise for our friend and atheism activist, Aziz. He is an atheism activist jailed in Kuwait on charges of blasphemy. And we really do need to make as much noise as possible. So if you could please go sign the petitions, like the pages, and share amongst your friends, it would be greatly appreciated. Any help we get is very, very much appreciated. So if you could please go ahead and do that, call the Kuwaiti embassy. Let them know that you think that blasphemy is barbaric, and let them know that this really tarnishes their image in your view of Kuwait.
Okay.
Remember, doing this helps improve your awesome points.
And I just have just a quick announcement for any of the Irish viewers. Yesterday we had another national meeting for Pro-Choice Ireland, or the Pro-Choice campaign. It's looking very good. We have another meeting coming up sometime in February. So if you want to come down, please do let us know. We'll add you into the group email. The security's on it is just a little bit tight at the moment because Youth Defence has a history of trying to infiltrate pro-choice groups in Ireland and intimidate any pro-choice supporters. So not to put anyone off.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone, for turning up. Thank you, Kitch.
Cheers. See you guys next week.
Marty?
My pleasure.
Wombo?
Hello, goodbye.
Yes. Lundy?
See you, everybody.
All right. And thank you very much, Ali, for dropping by and helping out.
Thank you guys for having me.
And, of course, a very big thank you to Tracy, and thumbs up in the chat room for her. And we'll see you all next week. Good night, everyone. Bye.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.